A green logo appears in bold slanting letters over a blue planet in space. Turner. Now, a logo of a thickly maned lion framed by a ring of film. Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer. Blue lines slide diagonally across an electric green screen, intersected by vertical lines shooting upward. Slanting titles appear on the grid. Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer presents Cary Grant as Roger Thornhill, Eva Marie Saint as Eve Kendall, and James Mason as Philip Van Damme in Alfred Hitchcock's North by Northwest. Copyright 1959 by Lowe's Incorporated. This film is described for blind and visually impaired audiences by Descriptive Video Service, WGBH Boston. Described by Brian Gould and Samantha Manahan. Read by Rena Baskin. Funded by the United States Department of Education. The green grid dissolves into the glass facade of a skyscraper. In the window's reflections, we see cars passing below on a city street. More titles, co-starring Jesse Royce Landis, with Leo G. Carroll, Josephine Hutchinson, Philip Ober, Martin Landau, Adam Williams, Edward Platt, Robert Ellenstein, Les Tremaine, Philip Coolidge, Patrick McVeigh, Edward Binns, and Ken Lynch. Written by Ernest Lehman. Music by Bernard Herrmann. Director of Photography, Robert Burks, ASC. Production designed by Robert Boyle. Art directors, William A. Horning and Merrill Pye. Set decorations, Henry Grace and Frank McKelvey. Special effects, A. Arnold Gillespie and Lee LeBlanc. Film editor, George Tomasini, ACE. The events, characters, and firms depicted in this photoplay are fictitious. Any similarity to actual persons living or dead, or to actual firms, is purely coincidental. Our lofty view dissolves to street level outside the skyscraper's revolving front doors, where professionals exit into dense pedestrian traffic. More titles. Associate producer Herbert Coleman, directed by Alfred Hitchcock. A bald, portly man just misses a bus. Inside an office building, business people pour out of a crowded elevator. The tall, silver-haired Roger Thornhill strides out with his blonde secretary.
High Trentex automatically means a rising sales curve, which incidentally...
Mr. Thornhill?
Good night, Eddie. Say hello to the missus.
We're not talking.
My recommendation is still the same. Dash. Spread the good word in as many small-time segments as we can grab. And let the opposition have their high ratings while we cry about it all the way to the bank. Why don't we colonize the colony one day next week for lunch? Let me hear from you, Sam. Happy thoughts, etc., etc. Come on, you better walk me to the plaza.
I didn't put a coat on.
Here's your blood sugar, child. Come on.
Outside.
Next.
Gretchen Shapps.
Oh, yes. Send her a box of candy from Blount. $10. You know the kind. Each piece wrapped in gold paper. She'll like that. She'll think she's eating money. Just say to her, darling, I count the days, the hours, the minutes.
You sent that one last time.
I did? Oh, well, put something for your sweet tooth, baby, and all your other sweet parts. I know.
Oh, can we take a cab, Mr. Thornhill?
What, for 2 blocks?
You're late and tired.
You know, that's your trouble, Maggie. You don't eat properly. All right. Here, taxi?
He stops a man.
I beg your pardon. I have a very sick woman here. You don't mind, do you?
Well, no. You're perfectly all right.
They climb in.
First stop the plaza. Don't show the flag.
Poor man.
Oh, come. I mean, I'm a happy man. I mean, you feel like a good Samaritan.
I knew you were lying.
Maggie, in the world of advertising, there's no such thing as a lie. There's only the expedient exaggeration. You ought to know that. Say, do I look heavyish to you?
What?
I feel heavyish. Put a note on my desk in the morning. Think thin.
Think thin.
Better make it the 59th Street entrance, driver.
Okay.
Oh, as soon as you get back to the office, call my mother. Remind her we've got those theater tickets for tonight. Dinner at 21, 7 o'clock. I'll have had 2 martinis at the Oak Bar, so she even bothered to sniff my breath.
She doesn't do that.
Sure she does, like a bloodhound.
Bigelow at 10:30 is your first for tomorrow. You do it the Skin Glow rehearsal at noon, then lunch with Falcon and his wife.
Oh, yeah, where was that?
Larry and Arnold's, 1 o'clock.
Uh-huh.
Will you check in later?
Absolutely not. Hey, driver, take this lady back where she belonged.
Right.
That'll cover it.
Roger pays him.
And don't forget, call my mother right away.
I won't. Good night, Mr. Thornhill.
Good night, sweetie.
He climbs out of the taxi and shuts the door.
Oh, wait, Maggie, you can't call her. She's a missus.
Wearing a trim gray suit, he watches the taxi drive off, then glances at his watch and enters the elegant Plaza Hotel. With long, brisk strides, he crosses the marble lobby, checks the time again, then turns down a hall toward the Oak Room. In the doorway of the posh oak-paneled lounge, a balding maitre d' in a white tuxedo greets him with a smile.
evening, Mr. Thornton.
Good evening, Victor. I'm looking for Mr. Weltner and two other gentlemen.
Yes, sir. Right this way.
They step to a nearby table.
Thurman? Ah, I'm a little late.
Roger Thornhill, Fanning Nelson.
How do you do?
How are you?
Larry Wade. We got a little head start here, Mr. Thornhill.
Oh, that won't last long.
Spelling Larry and Fanning, you may be slow in starting, but there's nobody faster coming down the home stretch. What's the matter, Roger? You got the fidgets?
Oh, well, I just did something pretty stupid. I told my secretary to call Mother, and I realized she won't be able to reach her where she is.
Oh, why not?
Well, she's playing bridge at the apartment of one of her cronies.
Your secretary?
No, my mother. George, one of his brand new apartments, all wet paint and no telephone yet. George, perhaps if I sent her a telegram.
Mr. George Kaplan?
Boy!
Two gruff men sternly watch Roger beckon a bellhop.
Kaplan.
I've got to get off a wire immediately. Could you send it for me if I write it out for you here?
Oh, I'm not permitted to do that, sir, but if you'll follow me.
Oh. Would you excuse me, gentlemen?
Go right ahead.
Roger follows the bellhop to the doorway.
Right through there, sir.
As Roger heads out, one of the gruff men grabs his shoulder.
Hey, wait a minute. What's that supposed to be?
Car's waiting outside. You will walk between us saying nothing.
What are you talking about?
Let's go.
Let's go where? Who are you?
Mere errand boys carrying concealed weapons. His is pointed at your heart. So please, no errors of judgment, I beg of you.
Oh, come on, fellas. What is this, a joke or something?
Yes, a joke. We will laugh in the car. Come.
Oh, this is ridiculous.
Gripping his arms, the henchmen firmly escort Roger toward the door. Wearing a fedora, one man jabs a pistol into Roger's back, prodding him into the back seat of a gray Cadillac limousine. Sandwiched between the gun-wielding henchman and his slick-haired partner, Roger strokes his cleft chin.
Don't tell me where we're going. Surprise me. You know, I left some friends back there in the Oak Bar. They're going to think I'm awfully rude. I mean, couldn't we stop off at a drugstore for a moment so that I can explain I'm being kidnapped? Well, that is what's happening, isn't it?
The henchmen stare bluntly ahead. Suddenly, Roger lunges for the door. He tugs on the handle, then sits back with a faint grin.
Locked.
Later, the Cadillac turns down a gravel driveway past a wrought iron sign which reads Townsend. In the back seat, Roger glances out the rear window, then keenly eyes the slick-haired henchman.
Who's Townsend? Really? Interesting.
The henchmen stare blankly ahead. Gazing out the window, Roger glimpses a sweeping brick manor, then furrows his brow at his escorts. Roger has tan, chiseled features and a tall, athletic build. The Cadillac winds down the long, tree-lined driveway toward the three-story Georgian mansion. As the limo rolls to a stop by the front steps, the fedora-capped henchman hops out. Gripping the pistol in his pocket, he carefully watches Roger climb out. The slick-haired henchman rings the doorbell. A stout, poker-faced housekeeper opens the door. While the slick-haired man and Roger head inside, the other henchman dashes around the side of the house.
Where is he?
Upstairs, dressing.
Tell him I'm here.
The dinner guests are expected.
Never mind that. Say to him, Kaplan.
By the way, what are we having for dessert?
Is there anyone in the library?
No.
This way.
The woman heads upstairs as Roger and his escort cross the foyer, which is richly ornamented with a crimson oriental rug and mahogany furniture. They enter a book-lined library.
You will wait here.
Well, don't hurry. I'll catch up on my reading.
The henchman leaves. Roger tries the door handle, then sighs, and glances around the elegant room. He steps over to the desk, picks up a cardboard mailing tube, and reads the address label. Mr. Lester Townsend, 169 Baywood, Glen Cove, New York. Pale sunlight spills into the room through a bay window. Glancing outside, Thornhill watches the fedora-capped henchman approach a lanky, dark-suited man who plays croquet. The lanky man gestures toward the house with his mallet, and the henchman nods. Dropping his mallet, the lanky man briskly follows his associate. Roger turns quickly around as a slim gentleman in his 50s enters the library.
Good evening.
He wears a dark three-piece suit and strides across the room, exchanging a scrutinizing stare with Roger. With his jaw firmly set, Roger sidles away from him. The gentleman draws the curtains, immersing the room in shadows. Under Roger's piercing gaze, the gentleman flicks on a lamp. His austere features glow in the harsh white light.
Not what I expected. A little taller. A little more polished than the others.
Oh, I'm so glad you're pleased, Mr. Townsend.
But I'm afraid just as obvious.
And what the devil is all this about? Why was I brought here?
The gentleman sits down.
Games? Must we?
Not that I mind a slight case of abduction now and then, but I have tickets for the theater this evening. To a show I was looking forward to. And I get, well, kind of unreasonable about things like that.
With such expert play acting, you make this very room a theater.
The lanky man enters.
Ah, Leonard. Have you met our distinguished guest?
He's a well-tailored one, isn't he?
My secretary is a great admirer of your methods, Mr. Kaplan. Elusiveness, however misguided...
Wait a minute. Wait. Did you call me Kaplan?
I know you're a man of many names, but I'm perfectly willing to accept your current choice.
Current choice? My name is Thornhill. Roger Thornhill. There's never been anything else.
Of course.
So obviously, your friends picked up the wrong package when they bundled me out here in the car.
Do sit down, Mr. Kaplan.
I told you, I'm not Kaplan, whoever he is.
Excuse me.
Yes?
The guests are here, dear.
Look after them. I'll be with you in a few minutes. Now, shall we get down to business?
I'm all for that.
Quite simply, I'd like you to tell me how much you know of our arrangements. Oh. And, of course, how you've come by this information. Naturally, I don't expect to get this for nothing.
Of course not.
Don't misunderstand me. I don't really expect you to fall in with this suggestion. But the least I can do is afford you the opportunity of surviving the evening.
Roger eyes him sharply.
What the devil is that supposed to mean?
Why don't you surprise me, Mr. Kaplan, and say yes?
I've already told you.
We know where you're headed for.
And I know where I'm headed. I'm headed for the Winter Garden Theater in New York, and I think I'd better get going.
Roger marches to the door and opens it to find the slick-haired henchman. Roger turns back around, clenching his jaw in frustration.
Townsend, you're making a serious mistake.
This is not going to lead to a very happy conclusion, Mr. Kaplan.
I'm not Kaplan.
I do wish you'd reconsider.
We also know your contact in Pittsburgh since Jason committed suicide.
What contact? I've never even been in Pittsburgh.
On June the 16th, you checked into the Sherwin Hotel in Pittsburgh as Mr. George Kaplan of Berkeley, California. A week later, you registered at the Benjamin Franklin Hotel in Philadelphia as Mr. George Kaplan of Pittsburgh. On August the 11th, you stayed at the Statler in Boston. August the 29th, George Kaplan of Boston registered at the Whittier in Detroit. At present, you're registered in room 796 at the Plaza Hotel in New York as Mr. George Kaplan of Detroit.
Really?
In 2 days, you're due at the Ambassador East in Chicago. And then at the Sheraton Johnson Hotel in Rapid City, South Dakota.
Not me.
So you see, there's very little sense in maintaining this fiction that you're deceiving us any more than we're deceiving you, Mr. Kaplan.
I don't suppose it would do any good to show you a wallet full of identification cards, driver's license, things like that.
They provide you with such good ones. It's getting late. I have guests. Do you intend to cooperate with us? I'd like a simple yes or no.
A simple no. For the simple reason I simply don't know what you're talking about.
Townsend steps aloofly past him and heads for the door.
Give Mr. Kaplan a drink, Leonard. A pleasant journey, sir.
He leaves, summoning two waiting henchmen with a flinty glance. Stern and forbidding, they block the doorway as Leonard opens the cabinet door of a liquor-stocked secretary.
Scotch? Rye? Bourbon? Vodka?
Nothing, thank you. I'll just take a quick ride back to town.
Oh, that has been arranged.
But first,
a libation.
Bourbon.
You drink it. I've had enough stimulation for one day.
It'll be easier if you take this yourself. Otherwise, it'll be necessary for us to insist.
Roger lunges for the door. The henchmen grab his arms, wrestle him to the sofa, and pin him on his back. Breathing heavily, Roger watches Leonard fill a highball glass with straight bourbon.
Cheers.
He fills it all the way to the top. Nighttime. At a bend in a narrow two-lane road, a white convertible Mercedes is parked in front of the gray Cadillac. Along the road's edge, steep cliffs drop suddenly to the ocean. The two henchmen pull Roger out of the Cadillac's back seat and haul him over to the Mercedes, his rubbery legs dragging across the pavement. They shove him into the driver's seat. Up ahead, surf pounds the jagged shoreline where the road banks hard right. Behind the steering wheel, Roger's head bobs loosely. From the passenger seat, the slick-haired henchman turns on the ignition.
Don't worry about me, fella. I'll take the bus.
The slick-haired henchman steers the convertible toward the cliff's edge. Roger's droopy eyes snap open. Roger shoves the henchman out of the car, grabs the wheel, and nods off. The Mercedes swerves toward the ledge. Spinning the steering wheel, Roger skids to a stop. The back left tire dangles over the edge. He looks 100 feet down at the rocky shoreline below his spinning tire, then blinks his bleary eyes and pulls away. The henchmen follow in the Cadillac. Up ahead, Roger furrows his brow in concentration as he speeds through sharp turns. His heavy-lidded eyes fight to focus. He veers away from the woods, crosses lanes, and forces an oncoming car to swerve around him. Rounding a bend, Roger's headlights beam on a tree. He steers hard left just in time. With his eyes glued to the twisting road, he zigzags at breakneck speed. He zooms past a sedan, driving it into a sandbank. Behind him, the henchmen follow in hot pursuit. Squinting behind the wheel of the Mercedes, Roger sees double. Two blurred roads overlap, then turn in different directions. Roger focuses in time to swerve away from a telephone pole. Bleary-eyed, he cruises down a straight stretch of road, directly toward a stopped car. He dodges left, weaves the oncoming traffic, then ducks back into his own lane. With a dazed, goggling stare fastened on the dark road, Roger whizzes past a parked Glen Cove police car, just missing an officer. The policeman climbs in and peels out. Roger swerves along the dotted white line, oblivious to the cruiser's flashing red light behind him. He twists his gaze in a moment of wonder, then shakes his head quizzically. His heavy-lidded eyes blink rapidly with exhaustion. In front of him, a bicyclist crosses an intersection. Roger gapes and brakes hard. The cruiser rear-ends him. A sky blue sedan crashes into the cruiser. Two officers climb out of the sandwiched police car and saunter up to Roger. Up the road, the henchmen turn around and drive away from the pileup. Later, the two officers strong-arm Roger into the station house. Behind a desk, a police lieutenant watches him stumble closer.
Thanks for the lift, fellas.
Lieutenant, I want this man examined for driving while intoxicated.
Really?
Yeah. You see, they try to kill me. You know, he won't listen to me. In a big house, they try to kill me.
All right, let's just go inside.
I don't want to go inside. Somebody call the police.
Come on. Come on now.
Oh, okay.
The lieutenant passes one officer some paperwork. The other supports Roger as he staggers into a small courtroom.
Sit down.
Roger lies on a bench.
I don't want to sit. I'm perfectly all right, see? We'll get him. We'll throw a book at him. Assault and kidnapping. Assault with a gun and bourbon and a sports car. We'll get him.
You'll be all right after a good night's sleep. We got a nice cell all made up and waiting.
I don't want a cell. I want a policeman.
Car was just reported stolen. Mrs. Babson up on Twining Road.
All right. I got a call somehow. Where's the phone?
You're allowed one call.
Over here.
Oh, thanks.
You better make it your lawyer.
Butterfield 81098.
What am I, a telephone operator?
Butterfield 81098.
The officer reluctantly picks up the receiver and dials. Roger smooths the front of his steel gray suit, straightens his silk tie, and sits on the desk. With drooping eyes, he tries to rest his head on the officer.
Now, just a minute, please. Here.
Hello, Mother? Mother, this is your son, Roger Thornhill. Yeah. Wait a minute, I'll find out. Where am I?
Glen Cove Police Station.
Glen Cove Police Station. No, Mother, I have not been drinking. No, these two men, they poured a whole bottle of bourbon into me. No, they didn't give me a chaser. No.
Come on, let's go.
I'm not finished yet.
Yes, you are. Come on.
Mother, I gotta go now. Will you get my lawyer right away and come out and bail me out?
Tomorrow morning, tell her.
Tomorrow morning, he says. Oh, I don't know. I'll ask her. She wants to know who says.
Sergeant Emil Klinger.
Sergeant Emil... Emil? Sergeant Emil Klinger. No, I didn't believe it either. I'm all right, Mother. Good night. Good night, dear.
He hands the phone back to the sergeant, who frowns and hangs it up.
That was Mother.
Let's go.
The sergeant helps him back into the courtroom, where the other officer chalks a straight line on the floor.
Here's your man, Doctor.
The sergeant sits Roger across from a doctor.
Oh. What's your name?
Roger Thornhill.
Stick out your tongue and say, ah.
You better move back.
Ah! Have you been drinking?
Doctor, I am gassed.
What were you drinking?
Well, bourbon. These two fellas...
How much would you say that you drank?
What do you say?
How much would you say that you drank?
He holds his hands about 2 feet apart.
Mr. Thornhill, it is my opinion that you were definitely intoxicated, and I'm now going to... And I'm now going to ask your permission to draw blood.
How disgusting.
You may refuse to permit a blood test to be made, but if you do refuse, your license...
In the morning, he and his lawyer stand before a judge. Of your own
choosing, it was at this point that Mr. Thornhill succeeded in escaping from his would-be assassins, and when they gave chase, he naturally had to drive as best he could under the circumstances.
Counselor, how long have you known your client?
7 years, Your Honor.
Do you know him to be a reasonable man?
Absolutely.
Mother.
And you believe there is some credence to this story?
Credence?
Well, yes, Your Honor. I mean, if my client says this is what happened, I'm certain it must have happened.
You're damn right.
Sergeant, I want this turned over to the county detectives for investigation. I suggest you call them up and have them come over here immediately.
Right, Your Honor.
Counselor, I'm going to set this over for final disposition tomorrow night at 7:30. At which time I expect you and the defendant to be here and ready to go to trial. In the meantime, the county detectives will determine if his story has any basis in fact.
Basis in fact? I suppose if I were brought in here dead, you still wouldn't believe...
Roger, wait a minute.
Well, I mean, after all, Your Honor, would I make up such a story?
That is precisely what we're intending to find out, Mr. Thornhill.
Later, a black sedan stops in front of the Townsend mansion. Roger, his mother, and three plainclothes detectives get out and climb the front steps. Roger rings the bell. His mother waits at his side, wearing a stylish fur-collared suit. The stout housekeeper opens the door.
Yes?
Remember me?
Yes, sir.
Good. Is Mr. Townsend at home?
No, I'm sorry, he's left for the day, sir.
Mrs. Townsend?
Who shall I say is calling?
County detectives.
Come in, please.
They file inside. Standing on the oriental rug, Mrs. Thornhill glances around the richly furnished foyer. Her short red hair curls around her fur hat.
This way, please.
The housekeeper opens the library door for the visitors. Roger glances around the elegant book-lined room, then nods confidently to the detectives.
This is the room.
I'll call Madam.
You do that.
And here's the sofa where they held me down. They spilled bourbon all over it. I'll show you the stains.
He lifts up a spotless sofa cushion.
Well, we must have cleaned them off. This is the cabinet where they keep the liquor. Scotch, gin, vodka.
Nothing but books.
And bourbon. I remember when it used to come in bottles.
Mrs. Townsend hurries in.
Roger, dear, we were so worried about you. Did you get home all right? Of course you did. Let me look at you. Oh, a little pink-eyed, but aren't we all? It was a dull party. You didn't miss a thing.
I want you all to know, I never saw this woman before last night.
Mrs. Townsend, I'm Captain Junkett of the Nassau County Detectives. This is Lieutenant Harding.
How do you do? You haven't gotten into trouble, Roger.
Now stop calling me Roger.
Has he gotten into trouble?
Mrs. Townsend, Mr. Thornhill was picked up last night driving while under the influence of alcohol and incidentally in a stolen car.
Stolen car?
Belonging to Mrs. Babson of Twining Road.
Roger, you said you were going to call a cab. You didn't borrow Laura's Mercedes.
No, I didn't borrow Laura's Mercedes.
Mr. Thornhill has told us that he was brought to this house against his will last night and forcibly intoxicated by some friends of your husband's, then set out on the road. Do you know anything about this?
Well, now, Captain, Roger was a bit tipsy when he arrived here by cab for dinner.
She's lying.
And I'm afraid he became even worse as the evening wore on. Finally, he told us he had to go home to sleep it off. I knew I should have served dinner earlier.
What a performance.
Mrs. Townsend, does the name George Kaplan mean anything to you?
George Kaplan? No.
I didn't think so.
Well, where's her husband? He's the one you should be questioning.
Is there any place he can be reached?
Why, yes. The United Nations.
United Nations?
He's addressing the General Assembly this afternoon.
They gape at Roger.
All right, so he's addressing the General Assembly.
Sorry we had to bother you.
No bother at all.
Mrs. Townsend smiles and shows her guests out.
Now, wait a minute.
Mrs. Thornhill scolds her son with an icy glare, then takes his arm and walks him to the foyer.
Will you be wanting to get in touch with my husband, Captain?
No, Mrs. Townsend, that won't be necessary.
Do you mean you're not going to do any more about this?
Roger, pay the $2.
Scowling, Roger stalks out. His mother and the detectives follow him to the black sedan. In the doorway, Mrs. Townsend grins and waves to them.
Goodbye.
The visitors pile into the car and drive off. Our view pans across the brick, ivy-grown facade of the Townsend mansion to the hedges where a gardener prunes. Dressed in tan overalls, the slick-haired henchman lowers his garden shears and aims a flinty stare down the driveway. Later, in Manhattan, a taxi stops in front of the Plaza Hotel. Roger and his mother climb out of the back seat.
I don't see why you want me along.
Well, you lend a certain air of respectability.
Don't be sarcastic, Roger.
They stride into the elegant marble lobby. Roger leads his mother around a corner to a counter with golden house phones.
Hey, Roger, park yourself there. Here goes.
Picks up a receiver.
Hello, operator. Have you got a George Kaplan staying here? That's right. You have? Room 796. Ring it, will you please? You see?
I see. Well, I hope he clears up this silly business. You're ruining my whole day.
Shut up. Oh, well, did he leave word when he'd be back? Really? Well, thank you. Well, that's odd. He hasn't answered his telephone in 2 days.
Maybe he got locked in the bathroom.
Well, do me a favor, will you? Put on that sweet, innocent look you do so well and go to the desk and get the key to 796.
Don't be ridiculous. I wouldn't do such a thing.
$10?
Not for all the money in the world.
50?
Roger, you are disgraceful.
Mm-hmm. She takes the cash. Later, they stride down a red-carpeted hallway.
Car theft, drunk driving, assaulting an officer, lying to a judge, and now housebreaking.
Not housebreaking, your hotel breaking. There's a difference.
Of 5 to 10 years. Just a minute, please.
The hotel maid hurries over.
Will you want me to be changing your bed, sir?
Yes, well, but not right now.
Well, I only mention it, sir, because the bed doesn't seem like it's been slept in, and I was just wondering if I ought to go on changing the linens, you know?
Thank you for your interest.
You're welcome, sir.
Furrowing his brow quizzically, Roger ushers his mother into Kaplan's spacious room.
Now, she seemed to think I'm Kaplan. I wonder if I look like Kaplan.
A crisp white shirt hangs on a chair, and a packed suitcase lies open near the bed. Roger steps over to the desk and picks up a photo in which Townsend poses with 6 men.
Oh, well, look who's here.
Who? Where?
Our friend who's assembling the General Assembly this afternoon.
Roger, I think we should go.
Don't be nervous.
I'm not nervous. I'll be late for the bridge club.
Good. You'll lose less than usual.
Roger steps over to the night table between 2 neatly made twin beds and rings housekeeping. With an inquisitive gaze, he wanders into the white-tiled bathroom and looks over the toiletries.
Bulletin. Kaplan has dandruff.
In that case, I think we should leave.
Too late.
Roger opens the door to the hotel maid.
You rang for me, sir?
Yes, come in a moment. What's your name?
Elsie, sir.
Elsie? Do you know who I am?
Sure, you're Mr. Kaplan.
When did you first see me?
Outside the door. On the hall a couple of minutes ago. Don't you remember?
And that's the first time you've laid eyes on me?
Can I help it if you're never around, Mr. Kaplan?
Well, then how do you know I'm Mr. Kaplan?
What?
How do you know I'm Mr. Kaplan?
Well, of course you are. This is room 796, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
So you're the gentleman in room 796, aren't you?
Mm. All right, Elsie, thanks.
Will that be all, sir?
For the time being, yeah.
Roger nervously opens the door to a young valet carrying a suit.
Valet.
Oh, yes, come in.
Elsie leaves.
Should I hang in the closet, Mr. Kaplan?
Yes, please.
Roger drops a hand in his pocket as the valet hangs the dark pinstriped suit in the closet.
Tell me, I've forgotten. What time did I give you that suit?
Last night, around 6.
Oh, did I give it to you personally?
Personally? Oh, no, Mr. Kaplan. You called on the phone and described the suit to me and said it would be hanging in your closet. Like you always do.
Mm-hmm.
Anything wrong?
Oh, I'm just curious.
Roger tips him.
Here, thanks.
Oh, thank you. Nice to meet you, Mr. Kaplan.
The valet pockets his cash and leaves. Roger frowns and shakes his head.
Isn't that the damnedest thing? I'm beginning to think that no one in the hotel has actually seen Kaplan.
Maybe he has his suits mended by invisible weavers.
Oh.
Roger slips off his jacket and takes Kaplan's suit out of the closet.
Let me see something.
He tries on the pinstripe suit jacket. It's small and tight. The short sleeves bare his white cuffs.
I don't think that one does anything for you.
Roger holds Kaplan's creased trousers up to his waist. The legs end mid-calf.
Ah, now that's much better.
Well, obviously, they've mistaken me for a much shorter man.
Roger glances from the phone to his mother.
Should I?
Certainly not.
He slips off the jacket.
Here, hold that there.
He picks up the receiver.
Hello.
It's good to find you in, Mr. Kaplan.
Who is this?
We met only last night, and still you do not recognize my voice. I should feel offended.
Yes, I know who you are, and I'm not Mr. Kaplan.
Of course not. You answer his telephone, you live in his hotel room, and yet you are not Mr. Kaplan. Nevertheless, we are pleased to find you in.
Now, wait. Hello, operator. Operator.
Yes?
Operator, this is Mr. Thorne. Kaplan in 796. That call that just came through, where did that come from? Was that an outside call, or did it come from the lobby?
Just a minute, sir. I'll see.
Well, hurry, please.
Who was it?
Only one of the men who tried to kill me last night.
Oh, we're back to that one, are we?
Hello, operator.
Mr. Kaplan.
Yes?
That call was made from the lobby, sir.
It was? It was from the lobby. They're probably on their way up here right now. Come on, let's get out of here.
I think I'd like to meet these killers.
Roger slips on his gray suit coat, grabs Townsend's photo from the desk, and leaves with his mother. They turn down a hall to wait outside a pair of elevator doors. The glass doors are adorned with ornate gold grills. One elevator stops on its way up, the other on its way down. As the cage doors slide open, the same two henchmen step out of the up elevator and follow Roger and his mother into the crowded down elevator. Roger recognizes his kidnappers, then catches his mother's eye and discreetly nods at them. She glances at the well-dressed men, then turns away from her son in disbelief. He taps her and insists with a firmer nod in their direction.
You gentlemen aren't really trying to kill my son, are you?
The henchmen exchange wide, toothy smiles. Roger presses his lips in a thin line.
Lobby, please. Watch your step.
Roger stops the henchmen.
Oh, no, gentlemen. Please, ladies first. Come along, ladies.
Roger leads them out.
Come along, good.
Roger! Roger, will you be home for dinner?
Cutting off a waiting couple, he ducks into a cab.
Where to?
I don't know. Just keep going.
Glancing out the back window, Roger sees the henchmen cut off the waiting couple, climb into a second cab, and follow. Beneath his dark, frowning brows, his steely eyes shift thoughtfully. He takes the photo of Townsend out of his pocket.
Take me to the United Nations.
Right.
General Assembly Building.
Right.
I'm being followed. Can you do anything about it?
Yes, I can.
Do it.
As the cab accelerates, Roger looks out the rear window. Later, his taxi stops outside the UN's General Assembly office, a sleek building about 10 stories high with smooth, slightly concave sides. Roger strides into the spacious modern lobby. Above his head, three curving terraces are supported by exposed square columns. He steps over to the front desk, where a young receptionist sits by a telephone and a microphone.
Yes, please. Where will I find Mr. Lester Townsend?
Mr. Lester Townsend of Unipo? Yeah. And did you have an appointment, sir?
Well, yes. He expects me.
Your name, please.
My name?
Yes, please.
Kaplan, George Kaplan.
She writes it down.
One moment, please.
Outside, the slick-haired henchman hops out of his cab.
Wait for me at the corner 47.
The cab leaves with his fedora-capped partner in the back seat. Inside, the receptionist hands Roger a pass.
If you give this to one of the attendants in the public lounge, she will be itching for you.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome, Mr. Kaplan.
Roger steps away from the desk as the slick-haired henchman hurries into the lobby and glances around. Later, Roger enters an upstairs lounge. Professionals relax on sofas.
Mr. Bernardi of the Swiss Observer's Office. Mr. Bernardi of the Swiss Observer's Office.
Roger hands a receptionist his pass.
Page Mr. Lester Townsend, please.
Certainly, Mr. Kaplan.
Mr. Townsend of Unipo. Mr. Townsend of Unipo. Please call at the communications desk of the public lounge.
At the lounge entrance, the slick-haired henchman slips on a black glove. He watches a balding, round-faced man approach the lounge desk.
Of Ceylon, United States Secretary, please.
Mr. Kaplan.
Yes?
You wanted to see Mr. Townsend.
Yes.
This is Mr. Townsend.
How do you do, Mr. Kaplan?
This isn't Mr. Townsend.
Yes, it is.
Well, there must be some mistake. Mr. Lester Townsend?
That's me. What can I do for you?
As they move into the lounge, the slick henchman slips out of sight.
Are you the Townsend who lives in Glencove?
That's right. Are we neighbors?
A large red brick house with a curved tree-lined driveway.
That's the one.
Were you at home last night, Mr. Townsend?
You mean in Glencove?
Yes.
No, I've been staying in my apartment here in town for the last month. I always do when we're in session here.
Oh, what about Mrs. Townsend?
My wife has been dead for many years.
Oh,
Now, Mr. Kaplan, what's this
Mr.
all about?
Oh, forgive me, but who are those people living in your house?
What people? The house is completely closed up. Just the gardener and his wife living on the grounds. Now, Mr. Kaplan, suppose you tell me who you are and what you want.
Roger shows him the photo.
Please, just a minute. Look, do you know this man?
Townsend gapes. The henchman dashes off. Gasping, Townsend collapses, a knife in his back. Roger catches him and yanks out the weapon. A photographer snaps a picture of Roger standing over Townsend, knife in hand.
He's got a knife! Look out!
Listen to me, I had nothing to do with this.
The crowd closes in.
Call the police!
Wait a minute. Don't come any nearer. Get back.
Roger stands toward the door, then drops the knife and dashes off. Our towering view looks down the sheer face of the skyscraper as a tiny figure races toward a cab. Now, inside the U.S. intelligence agency, one of five agents reads the front page of the Evening Star.
Photograph has been tentatively identified as that of Roger Thornhill, Manhattan advertising executive, indicating that the name of George Kaplan, which he gave to an attendant at the General Assembly building, is false. Possible motive for the slaying, suggested by the discovery that earlier today, Thornhill had appeared at Glen Cove, Long Island Police Court, charged with drunk driving with a stolen car. In his defense, he charged that the murder victim, Mr. Townsend, had tried to kill him the night before. Brother.
What about that?
Does anyone know this Thornhill?
No, not me.
Never heard of it.
Professor?
Apparently, the poor sucker got mistaken for George Kaplan.
How can he get mistaken for George Kaplan when George Kaplan doesn't even exist?
Ask me how it happened. Obviously, it happened. Van Damme's men must have grabbed him, tried to put him away, using Lester Townsend's house.
And the unsuspecting Mr. Townsend winds up with a stray knife in his back.
C'est la guerre.
So horribly sad, how is it I feel like laughing?
What are we going to do?
Do?
About Mr. Thornhill.
We do nothing.
Nothing.
That's right, nothing. Oh, we could congratulate ourselves on a marvelous stroke of good fortune. Our non-existent decoy, George Kaplan, created to divert suspicion from our actual agent, has fortuitously become a live decoy.
Yes, Professor. How long do you think he'll stay live?
Well, that's his problem.
What Mrs. Finley means is...
I know what she means.
We can't sit back calmly and wait to see who kills him first, Van Damme and company, or the police.
What can we do to save him without endangering our own agent?
Aren't we being just a wee bit callous?
No, my dear woman, we're not being callous. We didn't invent our non-existent man and give him the name of George Kaplan, establish elaborate behavior patterns for him, and move his prop belongings in and out of hotel rooms for our own private amusement. We created George Kaplan and labored successfully to convince Van Damme that this was our own agent hot on his trail for a desperately important reason.
Check.
Nobody's denying that.
Very well, then. We make the slightest move to suggest that there is no such agent as George Kaplan, give any hint to Van Damme that he's pursuing a decoy instead of our own agent, then our agent, working right under Van Damme's very nose, will immediately face suspicion, exposure, and assassination. Like the two others who went before.
Goodbye, Mr. Thornhill, wherever you are.
Now, in Grand Central Station. Sunlight filters weakly into the main hall through barred, arched windows. In the bustling crowd, two plainclothes detectives rendezvous with two police officers. The pair split up in opposite directions. In a nearby phone booth, Roger glances nervously out at the passing travelers.
Yes, dear, I know. Now listen to me, Mother, I beg you. I called the Plaza. Kaplan checked out. He went to the Hotel Ambassador East in Chicago. Yes, that's why I'm... But I can't go to the police, at least not yet. Well, you saw the newspapers. My fingerprints are on the knife. I'm a car thief, a drunk driver, and I murdered a man for revenge. I wouldn't have a chance. And I won't have until I find George Kaplan, who obviously knows what this is all about. No, dear, the train, it's safer. Well, because there's no place to hide on a plane if anyone should recognize me. So you want me to jump off a moving plane? Yes. Well, thank you so much, Mother. Yeah, well, goodbye.
He hangs up and steps out of the booth. A dark-suited man waits to enter. Roger looks him warily up and down, then winds his way into the crowd streaming through the Grand Hall. His eye catches the front page headline of a man's newspaper. It declares, "Manhunt on for UN killer." Roger hides his nervous gaze behind a pair of tortoiseshell sunglasses, then walks around an information kiosk. Leaning against the other side, two clean-cut policemen scan the crowd. Behind them, Roger strides over to a ticket window. A slouching agent stares dully through the glass.
Yeah. Give me a bedroom on the 20th century, please.
Leaving in 5 minutes.
Yes, I know. Could you make a snap in?
I think they're all sold out.
They're sold out?
You can always go coach.
No, I can't do that. What time is the next train?
Nothing till 10. You're in a hurry, huh?
Well, could you call them and see what they have?
Something wrong with your eyes?
Yes, they're sensitive to questions. Will you call them?
Sure.
The agent glances behind the counter at Roger's photo.
Don't go away.
The agent steps into the back room, picks up a phone receiver, and dials. Glancing over his shoulder, he cups his hand around the mouthpiece.
He's at window 15, upper level. Hurry. You're in luck, mistake.
He looks at the empty ticket window. In a station corridor, Roger strides briskly over to a gate attendant.
I'm just seeing some friends, though.
Roger glimpses the police.
Sorry, I'll have to know the name and space before I can let you through.
Just a minute! Hey, come here!
Roger rushes onto the platform alongside the New York Central train. Checking over his shoulder, he slows his pace to a brisk, nondescript walk and slips on board. Inside, he jogs down the narrow corridor of a sleeping car, glances out a side window, and glimpses two policemen rushing onto the train. He runs back the other way and stops short as a striking young woman with platinum blonde hair turns the corner and blocks his escape.
Oh.
Trying to pass, they move the same way.
Oh, I'm sorry.
My fault. Sorry.
Roger spots the policeman approaching behind him and hastily ducks into a compartment. The blonde woman points the officers down the hall.
He went that way. I think he got off.
The officers hurriedly follow her tip. Roger peers out and cracks a faint smile.
Thank you.
It's quite all right.
7 parking tickets.
All.
Roger watches her swaying hips as her shapely figure sashays down the hall in a snug black suit and jacket. Glancing out the window, Roger glimpses the policeman's legs as the train rolls away. Later, the train speeds north along the Hudson River. Above rolling mountains, the evening sky glows a bright, dusty pink. Inside a lounge car, passengers relax in armchairs and sofas. 2 uniformed Pullman conductors wander through. One talks to a middle-aged woman in a turquoise dress, then checks his list. Nodding, he moves on. Outside the closed restroom door, he and his partner pause to count from their list. They move on. Roger pops his head out of the restroom and watches them go, still wearing his sunglasses. With his right hand stuffed in his pocket, he strides briskly through the lounge car. As he passes a side table, he notices a newspaper, folds it up, and hides it underneath a stack of books. Later, he enters the dining car. Behind the dark lenses of his glasses, his eyes scan the crowd. A wiry, tuxedo-clad steward greets him.
Good evening, sir.
The steward leads him to the shapely blonde woman's table and pulls out a chair for him. Roger sits across from her. She gazes demurely, a faint smile grazing her full rouged lips.
Cocktail before dinner?
Yes, please, a Gibson.
Right away.
The steward hands him a menu, then leaves. Staring at Roger, she sips her tea. Her slender eyebrows arc gracefully over her sparkling blue eyes.
Well, here we are again.
Yes.
You recommend anything?
The brook trout. A little trouty, but quite good.
So?
A waiter brings his Gibson.
Brook trout. There, I think.
Yes.
Roger passes the waiter his order, glances warily up and down the dining car, then settles into his chair. With narrowed eyes, she coyly watches him adjust his sunglasses.
I know, I look vaguely familiar.
Yes.
You feel you've seen me somewhere before?
Mm-hmm.
Funny how I have that effect on people. There's something about my face.
It's a nice face.
You think so?
I wouldn't say it if I didn't.
He takes off his glasses.
Oh, you're that type.
What type?
Honest.
Not really.
Good, because honest women frighten me.
Why?
I don't know. Somehow they seem to put me at a disadvantage.
Because you're not honest with them?
Exactly.
Like that business about the 7 parking tickets?
What I mean is, the moment I meet an attractive woman, I have to start pretending I've no desire to make love to her.
What makes you think you have to conceal it?
She might find the idea objectionable.
Then again, she might not.
As she sips her tea, Roger raises his glass.
Think how lucky I am to have been seated here.
Well, luck had nothing to do with it.
Fate?
She shakes her head.
I tipped the steward $5 to seat you here if you should come in.
Her pressed lips curve in a coquettish smile.
Is that a proposition?
I never discuss love on an empty stomach.
You've already eaten.
But you haven't.
The waiter brings his meal. Roger's lean cheeks dimple with a charmed grin.
Don't you think it's time we were introduced?
I'm Eve Kendall. I'm 26 and unmarried. Now you know everything.
Tell me, what do you do besides lure men to their doom on the 20th Century Limited?
I'm an industrial designer.
Jack Phillips, Western Sales Manager for Kingby Electronics.
No, you're not. You're Roger Thornhill of Madison Avenue. And you're wanted for murder on every front page in America. And don't be so modest.
Whoops.
Oh, don't worry. I won't say a word.
How come?
I told you. It's a nice face.
Is that the only reason?
It's going to be a long night.
True.
And I don't particularly like the book I've started.
You know what I mean?
Oh, let me think. Yes, I know exactly what you mean.
Eve takes out a cigarette and rests her elbow on the table. Roger pulls a matchbook from his suit pocket. The front and back cover are inscribed with the initials R.O.T.
That's my trademark, ROT.
Roger O. Thornhill. What does the O stand for?
Nothing.
He strikes the match. Eve curls her slender fingers around his hand, then dips the tip of her cigarette into the flame and inhales. Lifting her chin, she shoots out a stream of smoke. As he draws the match away, she pulls his hand to her lips and gently blows out the flame. Roger meets her dreamy gaze with a quick, shy smile.
I'd invite you to my bedroom if I had a bedroom.
A roommate?
Nothing, not even a ticket. I've been playing hide-and-seek with the Pullman conductor ever since the train left New York.
How awkward for you.
Yes, isn't it? No place to sleep.
I have a large drawing room all to myself.
It doesn't seem quite fair, does it?
Drawing room E, car 3901.
Such a nice number.
It's easy to remember.
3901.
See?
No luggage.
Eve glances out the window as the train stops.
So?
Well, you wouldn't happen to have an extra pair of pajamas, would you?
Wouldn't I? Incidentally, I wouldn't order any dessert if I were you.
I get the message.
That isn't exactly what I meant. This train seems to be making an unscheduled stop, and I just saw two men get out of a police car as we pulled into the station. They weren't smiling.
Eve gets up from the table. Out the window, Roger spots the two men boarding the train, then quickly rises and tosses some cash on the table. He hurries through the dining room, glances cautiously back, then follows Eve into the next car. Later, Eve reads in her cabin with Roger hidden in the enclosed upper bunk.
I think you'd better go out and tell those police to hurry.
Patience is a virtue.
He's always breathing.
Just lie still.
Have you got any olive oil?
Olive oil?
I want to be packed in olive oil if I'm going to be a sardine.
Come in.
A portly man in a suit.
Who are you?
State police.
He shows his badge.
Your name, please?
Eve Kendall. Is anything wrong?
There was a man at your table tonight in the dining car.
Yes.
A friend of yours?
I never saw him before.
Is this the man?
Yes, I think so. It's not a very clear picture.
It's a wire photo. We just got it from the New York police.
Police?
He's wanted for murder.
Good heavens, no.
Stewart said you left the dining car together.
We might have happened to leave at the same time, but not together.
What did you two talk about?
Talk about?
Your waiter said that you were getting along pretty good with this Thornhill fellow.
Oh, is that his name, Thornhill?
You mean he didn't tell you?
He didn't tell me anything. All we did was chat about different kinds of food, train travel versus plane travel, that sort of thing. Rather innocuous, I must say, considering he was a fugitive from justice. Who did he kill?
He didn't say where he was going, did he?
No. I assume Chicago. You think perhaps he got off when you got on?
Look, if you happen to catch sight of him again, Miss,
Kendall.
Will you let us know?
I'm going to bed soon, and I intend to lock my door, so I doubt if I'll be seeing him or anybody else tonight.
Well, just in case you do, we'll be in the observation car at the rear of the train.
It's comforting to know that. Good night.
They leave.
Still breathing?
Either hurry up or get me a snorkel.
She opens her purse.
I'm looking for the can opener I stole from the porter.
She twists the can opener in the bunk's keyhole. It hinges down.
Hello there.
Hello. Lying contorted on the tiny bunk, Roger reaches into his breast pocket, pulls out his sunglasses and frowns. They're broken in two. He and Eve share a wry glance.
Tell me, why are you so good to me?
Shall I climb up and tell you why?
Roger offers a sly smile. Later, a rosy light settles low in the sky as the train speeds around a bend. In the cabin, Roger and Eve stand near the door in each other's arms.
You know, I've been thinking it's not safe for you to roam around Chicago looking for this George Kaplan man you've been telling me about. You'll be picked up by the police the moment you show your face.
Such a nice face, too.
Now, don't you think it'll be a better idea if you stayed in my hotel room while I located him for you, brought him to you?
Can't let you get involved. It's too dangerous.
I'm a big girl.
Yeah, and in all the right places, too.
Their lips meet in a soft kiss.
You know, this is ridiculous. You know that, don't you?
Yes.
I mean, we've hardly met.
That's right.
How do I know you aren't a murderer?
You don't.
I mean, maybe you're planning to murder me right here tonight.
Shall I?
Please do.
Eve purses her lips invitingly, and they join in a long, passionate kiss. Roger caresses her coiffed blonde hair as she gently strokes the back of his neck. Slowly, Roger pulls his tanned face back from hers, and Eve's lips part in a dreamy smile.
Beats flying, doesn't it?
We should stop.
Immediately.
I ought to know more about you.
Well, what more could you know?
You're an advertising man, that's all I know.
That's right.
He presses against her.
Oh, train's a little unsteady.
Oh, who isn't?
What else do you know?
You've got taste in clothes, taste in food.
He kisses her bare neck.
Taste in women. I like your flavor.
Eve's head rolls back in ecstasy as Roger pulls her closer and places gentle kisses on her delicate lips.
Words. Could probably make them do anything for you. Sell people things they don't need. Make women who don't know you fall in love with you.
I'm beginning to think I'm underpaid.
He presses his lips against hers. Lost in their kiss, he strokes her hair. Roger looks up.
Look out.
He squeezes into the washroom. They share a glance and he closes the door. Eve switches on the light and opens the door to her cabin.
Oh, Porter, don't bother with the washroom.
Yes, ma'am.
Oh, by the way, I found this on the floor. Does it belong to you?
Yes, ma'am. I've been looking all over for it.
I'll wait outside.
Thank you.
She hands him the can opener and leaves. In the narrow washroom, Roger checks his neat silver hair in the mirror. With a studious frown, he inspects a tiny shaving brush placed among other complimentary toiletries. He places it back and picks up a tiny shaving razor.
Thank you, Porter.
Thank you, Ben. Good night now. Good
night.
Roger smiles at the miniature razor.
Come out, wherever you are.
Roger slides open the door. Eve sits on the sheets of her turned-down bed.
Porter.
So I see.
Eve slips off her shoes as Roger turns down the light and sits beside her.
Now, where were we?
Here.
She pulls him close with a passionate kiss.
Ah, yes. Nice of him to have opened the bed.
Yes.
Only one bed.
Yes.
Well, that's a good omen, don't you think?
Wonderful.
Know what that means?
Mm-hmm.
What? Tell me.
It means you're going to sleep on the floor.
Cradling his face in her hands, she kisses him. Roger wraps his arms around her. As she nestles into his shoulder, her eyes flick open with an alert, anxious stare. In the corridor, the porter presses a cabin's buzzer. The door opens.
A message from the lady in 3901.
Hidden by the door, a hand reaches out and takes a slip of paper from him. Closing the door, the unseen man opens the note. What do I do with him in the morning? Signed, Eve. The man sits down. It's Leonard, the lanky henchman. Sitting beside Leonard, Lester Townsend's imposter reads the note, and the men share a sly smile. Outside, the vibrant colors of sunset glow above the choppy Hudson River. The next morning, Eve steps off the train, accompanied by a red cap carrying her luggage. She spots the detectives from last night and turns to the red cap. It's Roger.
You keep walking, I'll catch up.
Yes, ma'am.
He walks past them.
Anything to report, Miss Kendall?
Why, yes, I had a fine night's sleep.
No, I mean, have you seen the man we're looking for?
Oh, Mr. Thornycroft?
Thornhill.
Oh, no, I'm awfully sorry. Well, good luck to you both.
She smiles innocently, hurries down the platform, and rejoins Roger.
How are we doing?
Oh, I may collapse at any moment.
Not yet. First, we have to run the gauntlet. Look.
Walking in the opposite direction, two uniformed police officers look them over.
Now, I'm accustomed to having a load on, but what have you got in these bags?
Bowling balls, naturally.
Oh, naturally. Which one of these has my suit in it?
The small one underneath your right arm.
Oh, thanks. That ought to do the suit a lot good.
I'm sure Mr. Kaplan won't mind a few wrinkles.
Yeah, if he's still there. What time is it?
9:10.
9:10? He may have left his hotel room by now.
Well, I'll call him for you as soon as we get inside the station.
Thank you. I can do it.
A red cap and a phone booth? Slightly suspicious.
Well, all right. What are you going to tell him? You know what?
Mm-hmm. You want to see him right away. Terribly urgent. Matter of life and death. Mm-hmm. No explanations.
Right.
While I'm calling, go change your clothes.
Well, where do you propose I do that? In Marshall Field's window?
I sort of had the men's room in mind.
Did you now? You're the smartest girl I ever spent the night with on the train.
Gazing slyly over her shoulder, Eve spots Leonard and Townsend's imposter following them nonchalantly. Roger stares ahead to the station entrance.
I think we made it.
Behind them, a man in his underwear steps off the train and into a group of police.
Which way did he go?
The officers race toward the station. The stripped-down red cap reaches into his tattered undershirt and fingers through a thick wad of bills. Inside the crowded train station, plain-clothed policemen grab red caps by the shoulders, whirl them around, then charge to different ones. The red caps gaze back, startled. In the men's room, Roger stands in his undershirt and suit pants, brushing foamy white shaving soap all over his face. The two detectives rush in, look about, and hurry past the sinks. Roger watches them storm out. Then he slides the tiny razor from the train down his cheek, clearing a narrow swath of shaving soap from his face. Beside him, a burly man shaving with a straight razor gazes down at him. Roger holds up his inch-wide razor. Unamused, the man cocks an eyebrow and continues shaving. Roger clears a tiny patch under his nose. In the station, Eve sits in a phone booth, nodding her head and taking notes. Our view glides from Eve across a bank of occupied phone booths. In the last booth, Leonard gestures with his index finger as he speaks into the receiver. Eve nods her head as she listens. In his booth, Leonard hangs up. So does Eve. Their doors open simultaneously and they step out. Eve gazes down at a scrap of paper. Leonard stares straight ahead, then quickly walks away. Eve folds the paper, puts it in her purse, and gazes after Leonard. The cut of Eve's black tailored suit accents a small black stone hanging from the nape of her slender neck. Her short platinum blonde hair curls up to the corners of her jawline and frames her delicate, sophisticated face. With her red lips pursed tight, Eve raises her blue eyes and spots Roger. Emerging in his suit, Roger stands across the station. Eve quickly walks toward him, and they meet beside a wide column.
What took you so long?
Oh, a big face, small razor. Tell me, did you get Kaplan?
Yes.
Fine, what did he say?
Well, he'll see you, but not at the hotel under any circumstances. He'll see you on the outside.
Well, where? When?
Oh, I've got it all written down for you.
Oh, thanks.
You're to take the Greyhound bus that leaves Chicago for Indianapolis at 2 and ask the driver to let you off at Prairie Stop, Highway 41.
Mm-hmm. Prairie Stop, Highway 41. Good.
It's about an hour and a half's drive from Chicago.
Fine, I'll rent a car.
No car. Mr. Kaplan said bus. He wants to be sure you're alone.
All right. What'll I do when I get there?
Just wait beside the road. He'll be there at 3:30.
How'll I know him?
Well, he'll know you. You made the Chicago papers, too.
Yeah.
Have you got your watch set for Central Time?
Yes, I did that. Thanks. What's the matter?
Matter?
Yes, you seem... I don't know. You seem tense.
You know, you better go before the police run out of red caps.
We'll see each other again, won't we?
Sometime, I'm sure.
I never had a moment to thank you properly.
Please go.
Yes, but where will I find you?
I've got to pick up my bags now.
Oh, yes, well, these are the checks for the large cases. Wait a minute. Please.
She glances toward the door.
They're coming.
Roger studies her face for a long moment, then dashes away. As she watches him go, Eve's lips part and she blinks back tears. From a view of 100 feet above the ground, an arrow straight two-lane highway of faded gray asphalt splits an endless plain of dry brown farmland. Divided into massive sections, some farms are dappled with dark and light browns, another is patterned with crop rows running parallel to the highway, and others simply fade into the horizon. A bus rumbles along the highway and nears a dusty crossroads, which spill out between two fields. The bus comes to a brief stop, and a tiny figure steps out onto the road. As the bus disappears into the distance, the man stands alone on the boundless stretch of farms, indistinguishable from fence posts lining the roadside. In his crisp gray suit, Roger stands on the desolate roadside. Squinting, he turns to his left and gazes across a bare dirt field to the cloudless blue sky. He stares across the highway at a vast stretch of lifeless ground. Turning around, Roger eyes a crop duster airplane on the distant horizon, trailing a ribbon of fine white powder. Slipping his hands into his pockets, he stares at the dirt crossroad. A wooden sign points past a field of dry corn stalks 100 yards away. Driving in the same direction as the bus, a car glimmers along the highway. Roger watches the car pass, sighs, and gazes out over the fields. He spots another car approaching in the opposite direction. As the long black sedan nears him, Roger starts to slide his hands out of his pockets in anticipation. Roger's hands sink back into his pockets, and another vehicle motors toward him. He cranes his neck as he spots a tractor-trailer truck. Maintaining its speed, the tractor-trailer covers Roger with a veil of roadside dust. He wipes the settling dust out of his eye, watches the truck fade away, and looks across the highway. Emerging from behind the cornfield, a sedan rumbles along the dirt road. Roger eyes it steadily as the car turns and approaches the highway. A cloud of dust spirals from the rear tires of the steel blue sedan. Sunlight glints off the car's polished headlights, perched atop its wide fenders. Roger's hands slip out of his pockets as the car stops on the opposite side of the highway and a man gets out. The man says something to the driver, then waves. The car turns around and heads back down the dirt road. Wearing a brown suit and a fedora, the man stands at the edge of the pavement with his hands in the back pockets of his pants. Separated by 20 feet of desolate pavement, the two men stare at each other. Roger shifts his stance, and the lean, brown-suited man gazes up the road. Squinting, Roger studies the man, unbuttons his jacket, and impatiently bites his lower lip. The man stares back in a comfortable, slouching stance. Roger takes a quick look to his left, scanning the empty highway, then fixes his eyes on the man and strides across the road. Stopping an arm's length away, Roger makes eye contact and nods.
Huh.
The man holds his stare.
Hot day.
Seen worse.
Are you supposed to be meeting someone here?
Waiting for the bus. Due any minute.
Oh.
Some of them crop duster pilots get rich. They live long enough.
Yeah. Then your name isn't Kaplan.
Can't say it is, because it ain't. Here she comes, right on time.
He looks from the approaching bus to the distant crop duster.
That's funny.
What?
That plane's dusting crops where there ain't no crops.
The men watch the plane skimming over fields on the horizon as the silver bus nears them. The bus stops, and its door swings open. The man boards, then takes a quick look at Roger before the door closes and leaves him staring at the rounded, aqua-blue rear of the bus. Roger checks his watch, shakes his head, then plants his hands firmly on his hips. A slight breeze ruffles his tie as he watches the crop duster stop dusting, elevate, and bank in his direction. With an intrigued gaze, Roger watches the propeller-driven biplane descend gently as it approaches him dead on. The plane nears the highway and swoops lower. Roger dives to the ground as the plane's wheels pass just feet above him. Roger lifts his head. He kneels in the dirt as the plane takes a steep bank and turns for another pass. His puzzled face awash with fear, Roger dives into a drainage culvert an instant before the plane skims over him again. Bullets shatter the rocks beside him. Unscathed, Roger lifts his head. The crop duster wavers unsteadily as it flies over the fields across the highway and readies for another turn. Roger spots a car speeding down the highway. He gets out of the culvert, dashes into the road, and waves his arms at the boxy two-toned car. Standing exposed in the highway, Roger sighs and watches the car disappear. He shifts his gaze up to the seamless blue sky as the crop duster roars toward him, descending at a steep angle. His arms pump furiously as he races away and sprawls into the dirt, ducking under the plane's near miss. His head darting left and right, Roger spies a field of tall, dry corn stalks nearby. Leaping to his feet, he sprints toward them and charges through a row of the brittle plants. He disappears under the 7-foot-tall blanket of leafy stalks. As the crop duster nears, Roger lays on his belly, fully concealed from the plane. The stalks tremble around him as the plane passes overhead. Roger flashes a tight-lipped grin of relief. Then he cocks his head and spots the plane speeding in for another pass. The crop duster skims the cornfield and releases gaseous white powder. Roger ducks as the poisonous cloud settles over him. Covering his mouth with a handkerchief, Roger scurries to the edge of the cornfield and desperately scans his surroundings. He spots an oil tanker semi on the highway. Checking the plane's position, Roger races out of his cover and into the semi's path. He waves his arms as the semi closes in. 50 feet, 40 feet. The plane banks into another attack. 20 feet, 10 feet. Roger's eyes bulge. The truck skids to a halt right over him. He lies unhurt between the wheels. The crop duster collides with the truck's rear tank and explodes in a tremendous fireball. Two truckers jump out of the semi's cab.
Get out of here! The other tank may blow!
The truckers race into the cornfield. Roger shuffles wearily toward a pickup truck and a sedan, which stop on the roadside. The passengers run up. Roger points to the orange-black flames engulfing the tanker truck and the charred skeleton of the crop duster. A wiry farmer and three others gape at the flaming wreckage and take a few hesitating steps toward it. Roger slips behind them and gets into the pickup. With a refrigerator strapped upright in the bed, the pickup speeds away as the farmer spins around.
Hey!
He charges after his pickup. In a futile bow-legged sprint, the farmer chases the pickup as it disappears down the highway. Evening in Chicago. Two police officers inspect the pickup truck parked on a busy street. Standing beside a brick building, Roger looks across the street to a hotel. He wipes his forehead with his handkerchief and brushes dust off his lapel. With long, brisk strides, he crosses the street. A car with wide tail fins passes him. He enters the elegant wood-paneled hotel lobby. A woman in a mink stole walks her poodle across the red carpet. Fidgeting nervously, Roger stands at the concierge's desk.
Yes?
Could you let me have Mr. George Kaplan's room number, please?
Kaplan?
No.
I think he checked out.
He checked out?
That's right. Checked out at 7:10 this morning.
7:10? Are you sure?
Yes. Left a forwarding address. Hotel Sheraton Johnson, Rapid City, South Dakota.
7:10? Well, then how come I got a message from him at 9?
What's that?
Roger reads Eve's note.
Nothing.
The concierge turns his back and sorts the guest mail. Across the lobby, in a red dress with a plunging back, Eve stops at another desk. Roger's tanned face tightens as he watches her purchase a newspaper and step into an elevator. The elevator operator closes the door, and the floor numbers light up. First floor, second floor, third, fourth. The light holds on the number four, and Roger turns to the concierge.
Sorry to bother you again.
Uh-huh.
Miss Eve Kendall is expecting me. She's in room four something or other. I've forgotten the number. Would you mind?
The tuxedoed concierge flips through cards in a red leather box. He stops, checks the inside of a mail slot, then faces Roger.
She's in 463.
Oh, yes, that's right. Thanks.
He strides across the lobby and gets into an elevator. In the fourth floor hallway, Roger stops outside room 463 and listens at the door. His gray suit is spotted with patches of dust. He presses the room buzzer. The door opens. Eve's eyes widen.
Hello.
He walks in. Eve closes the door and sighs happily. Roger cracks a slight smile.
Surprised?
Yes.
No getting rid of me, is there?
Eve skips across the room and wraps her arms around Roger. He holds his arms away from her back and stares coldly around the room as she buries her face in his chest.
I could use a drink.
I have some scotch.
With water, no ice.
Eve steps to the bar and Roger spies a newspaper. Two die as crop duster plane crashes and burns.
How did it go today?
The meeting with Kaplan?
Uh-huh.
He didn't show up.
Oh?
It's funny, isn't it?
Why funny?
Oh, after all those involved and explicit directions he gave you on the phone?
Maybe I copied them down wrong.
I don't think you got them wrong. I think you sent me to the right place, all right.
Well, why don't you call him back again and see what happened?
I did. He checked out. Went to South Dakota.
South Dakota?
Mm-hmm. Rapid City.
Well, what are you going to do next?
Oh, I haven't made my mind up yet. It may depend on you.
Eve hands him a drink.
On me?
Sure. You're my little helper, aren't you? Thank you. To us. To a long and lasting friendship. Meaning, from now on, I'm not going to let you out of my sight, sweetheart.
I'm afraid you'll have to.
Oh, no.
I do have plans of my own, you know. And you do have problems.
Well, that wouldn't it be nice if my problems and your plans were somehow connected. Then we could always stay close to each other and not have to go off in separate directions. Togetherness, you know what I mean? Well, go ahead, it can't be for me.
Eve sits on the bed and lifts the receiver while Roger sips his drink.
Hello? Yes. No, not yet. I'm not ready. What time? I'll meet you. What's the address?
She writes it on a pad of paper.
Yes. Goodbye.
She tears off the top sheet and folds it in half.
Business?
Yes.
Industrial designing business?
Mm-hmm.
She slips it in her purse beside a pistol.
All work and no play? A girl like you should be enjoying herself this evening instead of taking phone calls from clients. What about having dinner with me?
You can't afford to be seen anyplace.
Well, let's have it up here, nice and cozy.
No,
She pushes him away.
I can't.
I insist.
I want you to do a favor for me. A big, big favor.
Name it.
I want you to leave right now. Stay far away from me and don't come near me again. We're not going to get involved. Last night was last night and that's all there was. And that's all there is. There isn't going to be anything more between us. So please, goodbye, good luck, no conversation, just leave.
Right away?
Yes.
No questions asked?
Yes.
No, I can't do that.
Please.
After dinner.
Now.
After dinner. Fair is fair.
All right. On one condition. That you let the hotel valet do something with the suit first. You belong in the stockyards looking like that.
Okay.
He eyes her suspiciously.
There's the phone.
He sits on the bed and lifts the receiver.
Hello. Valet service, please.
He picks up the pad of paper and studies it under a lamp.
A valet? Oh, this is... Oh, where are we?
463.
Room 463. How quickly can you get a suit sponged and pressed? Yes, fast. 20 minutes? Fine. Okay, 463. He'll be right up.
Better take your things off.
Yeah. Now, what could a man do with his clothes off for 20 minutes? Couldn't he have taken an hour?
You could always take a cold shower.
That's right.
She peels off his jacket.
Now, when I was a little boy, I wouldn't even let my mother undress me.
You're a big boy now.
Yes.
Roger takes her hands and stares into her eyes.
Tell me, how does a girl like you get to be a girl like you?
Lucky, I guess.
Oh, not lucky, naughty. Wicked, up to no good. Ever kill anyone? Because I bet you could tease a man to death without half trying. So stop trying, huh?
He pinches her cheek, walks into the bathroom, and shuts the door.
Be with you in a minute.
She picks up Roger's jacket and knocks on the bathroom door.
Trousers, please.
Roger hands Eve his trousers. She opens the room door and gives the suit to a valet.
Thank you.
I think I'll take that cold shower after all.
Good.
Hurrying around the room, Eve picks up her coat and purse. She opens a desk drawer, pulls out some papers, and slips them into her purse. On her way to the door, she notices something that Roger laid beside the phone. It's the photo of Townsend's imposter. In the bathroom, Roger stands in his shirt and tie, spying on Eve through the slightly open door. She opens the room door and creeps out. Roger walks across the room and sits on the bed beside the phone. He rubs a pencil across the small pad of paper. An indented address appears under the pencil lead's shading, 1212 North Michigan. Later, Roger gets out of a pea-green taxi. He approaches the glass doors of building number 1212. Next to a display window, a bronze placard reads, "Gallery, auction tonight." Roger enters.
This magnificent pair of Louis XVI Fauteuil. Original gilt finish, upholstered in pure silk damask. How much may I say to start? What am I bid?
100.
100 is bid, thank you.
Sitting in the auction room, Townsend's impostor caresses Eve's bare neck. Beside them sits the tall, slender Leonard.
300. 400 by the little lady. Thank you, sir. 450 is bid for the pair. Can I hear 500?
The trio sits to the far left of the room, separated from the crowded rows of well-dressed bidders. On a stage, uniformed attendants stand on either side of a pair of pink gilt armchairs. The auctioneer calls from a podium at the far right of the room. Standing in a doorway at the back of the room, Roger glowers over the crowd at Eve and the gentleman rubbing her neck.
In excellent condition. Restart the bidding. How much? 800 is offered, thank you. 800 is bid. Say the nine, go 900. 900 is bid.
Now with his shoulders tensed, Roger walks stiffly into the room and hovers over Eve's shoulder.
Say 1100. Can I hear 1100? Selling at 1000.
The three of you together. Now that's a picture only Charles Adams could draw.
Good evening, Mr. Captain.
Before we start calling each other names, perhaps you'd better tell me yours. I haven't had the pleasure.
You disappoint me, sir.
I was just going to say that to her.
I always understood you were a pretty shrewd fellow at your job. What possessed you to come blundering in here like this? Could it be an overpowering interest in art?
Yes, the art of survival.
He looks at Leonard.
Well, have you poured any good drunks lately?
$100.
He followed me here from the hotel.
He was in your room?
Sure, isn't everybody?
The impostor gazes at Eve warily and slips his hand off her shoulder. Eve's eyes flit about nervously. In front of them, an auction attendant displays a 2-foot-high statue of a tribal African. Leonard trades a quick glance with his boss.
I have 400. I have 400.
I didn't realize you were an art collector. I thought you just collected corpses.
500.
500, thank you.
I'll bet you paid plenty for this little piece of sculpture. Now the
700.
She's worth every dollar of it. Take it from me. Now she puts her heart into her work. In fact, her whole body.
Sold then to Mr. Van Damme at 700. Number 106 for your pleasure is the...
Oh, Mr. Van Damme.
Has anyone ever told you that you overplay your various roles rather severely, Mr. Kaplan? First, you're the outraged Madison Avenue man who claims he's been mistaken for someone else. Then you play the fugitive from justice, supposedly trying to clear his name of a crime he knows he didn't commit. Now you play the peevish lover, stung by jealousy and betrayal. Seems to me you fellows could stand a little less training from the FBI and a little more from the actor's studio.
Apparently, the only performance that'll satisfy you is when I play dead.
In your very next role, you'll be quite convincing, I assure you.
Leonard stares menacingly into Roger's eyes, then walks out of the room. Roger turns to Van Damme.
400 is me.
I wonder what subtle form of manslaughter is next on the program. Am I to be dropped into a vat of molten steel and become part of a new skyscraper? Or are you going to ask this female to kiss me again and poison me to death?
Eve swings at him, but Roger grabs her arms.
Who are you kidding? You have no feelings to hurt.
Eve sits with a sullen frown. Unnoticed among the bidders, the professor from U.S. Intelligence Agency watches Roger and Van Damme.
Mr. Kaplan, we've had just about enough of you.
Then why don't you send for the police?
600.
That's the last thing you'd want, isn't it? Me in the hands of the police. There's something I might tell them. And that's the reason you had this one here hustle me on the train last night. Or something seems to tell me I've got a much better chance of survival if I go to the police. Good night, sweetheart. Don't think it wasn't nice.
Say the 12.
He turns his back and walks up the aisle. Eve stares ahead with tears welling up in her eyes. Reaching the back of the room, Roger stops short. The slick-haired henchman blocks the exit and menacingly reaches into his pocket.
$1,200.
Roger heads back down an aisle as attendants bring a painting onto the stage.
Now catalog number 109.
Leonard steps onto the stage and blocks his exit. Roger heads for the wings.
17th century master. It will enhance any collection of fine art. What is your pleasure?
Leonard slinks beside the auctioneering table. Roger quickly gestures to a female bidder and squeezes into her seat.
$1,250 I have. Now $1,500. $1,500 is bid. Thank you.
Roger checks around the room. The slick-haired henchman takes a few steps forward as Van Damme takes Eve's arm and leads her out of the room.
I have $2,000. Do I hear $2,500? $2,500, anyone? $2,250 once.
Nervously, Roger catches Leonard's steely gaze, then raises his finger.
Last call.
$1,500.
Well, the bid is already up to $2,250, sir.
I still say $1,500.
Leonard's eyes shift to the auctioneer.
I have $2,250. Do I hear $2,500? $2,250 once. $2,250 twice.
$1,200.
Sold for $2,250. And now?
$2,250 for that chromo.
The auctioneer looks up, then back at his list.
Number 110 in the catalog. A Louis XV carved and gilded Lady Ripcole. Would somebody start the bidding at $750, please?
How do we know it's not a fake? It looks like a fake.
A gray-haired woman turns to Roger.
Well, one thing we know, you're no fake. You're a genuine idiot.
Thank you.
I wonder if I could respectfully ask the gentleman to get into the spirit of the proceedings here?
All right, I'll start it at 8.
800, thank you. 900, 1,000 is bid. Go 12.
11.
11 is bid. Thank you. Go 12. I have 11. Go 12. We'll say 12. 11 once. We'll say 12.
A man raises his hand twice. As Roger slyly peers around the room.
12 is bid. I have 12. Go 13. We'll say 13.
$13.
You mean $1,300, sir?
No, I mean $13. That's more than it's worth.
I have $1,200. Go 13. Who'll say 13?
An assistant steps from the podium and whispers to a woman who picks up a phone receiver. They frown at Roger as she dials. He grins back.
$1,200 twice. Last call, $1,200.
$2,000.
Leonard looks about nervously. The auctioneer gapes.
$2,000?
$2,100.
I'm sorry, sir, but we can't...
Make it $2,500.
The henchman shifts uneasily behind the last row of restless bidders.
Would the gentleman please cooperate?
The last bid was $1,200.
$2,500. My money is as good as anybody. Isn't it?
I have...
What was it?
$1,200.
I have $1,200 once. $1,200 twice.
$3,000.
Sold for $1,200.
A tall, stern-faced guard takes hold of Roger.
Now, I'm not going to let you get away with that. That's unfair.
You'd better leave, sir.
No, you take your hands off me or I'll sue you.
He spots two cops and slugs the guard. The guard lunges. Roger hits him in the gut and they fall to the floor. Leonard helplessly watches the struggle as the officers wrestle Roger to his feet.
Oh, it took you so long.
Let's take a little walk.
Well, now, wait a minute.
Get moving.
I haven't finished bidding yet. 3,000. I bid 3,000.
They pass the henchman.
Oh, sorry, old man. Too bad. Keep trying. Sounds so rough.
They drag him through a hallway where the professor slips into a phone booth. Outside, they haul Roger to a patrol car.
Handle with care, fellas.
In there.
I'm valuable property.
In.
One officer sits with Roger in the back seat. The other drives.
I want to thank you, gentlemen,
for saving my life.
Thank you, my friend.
Thank you.
Save it to the station.
The officers frown as they pull into traffic.
Well, let's have some smiles and good cheer. You're about to become heroes. Don't you know who I am?
You'll find out as soon as we book you for being drunk and disorderly.
Drunk and disorderly? That's chicken feed. You've hit the jackpot. Chicago police capture United Nations killer. My name is Roger Thornhill. Here.
The driver glances back at Roger, then down at a picture.
It's him.
That's right. Congratulations, man.
Yeah.
This is 1055, Sergeant Flam. We've got a man here who answers to the description of Thornhill, Roger, code 76, wanted by NYPD, positive ID. Absolutely, no question. Michigan Avenue, proceeding north to 42nd Precinct. What? Come again?
Roger trades a glance with the officer beside him.
You sure? Okay. Right. Yeah, I got it. 1055, off in the clear.
Where are we going?
Careful.
Well, what?
Orders.
Airport? You didn't go to the airport. I want to be taken to police headquarters.
You do, huh?
Well, why do you think I sent for you fellows?
What about this guy, Charlie? He sent for us.
Sit back.
Well, didn't you hear what I said? I want to be taken to police headquarters. I'm a dangerous assassin. I'm a mad killer on the loose.
You ought to be ashamed of yourself.
Later, the patrol car comes to a stop at a long, narrow airport building. Above the door, a sign reads, Northwest. The officers escort Roger inside. Inside, well-dressed travelers stand in several lines in front of a ticket counter. Above them, a sign reads, Northwest Airlines. The officers scan the room.
Sit right here.
Does anyone mind if I sit down? I've been running all day.
Carrying a beat-up suitcase, the professor scrambles to the counter and receives a ticket envelope. Then the bespectacled older gentleman joins the officers.
Thought I'd never make it. I'm getting too old for this kind of work. All right, men. Thank you. This way, Mr. Thornhill. We haven't much time. This way is more crowded.
He ushers Roger to a door and outside.
I don't think I caught your name.
I don't think I pitched it.
You're police, aren't you, or is it FBI?
FBI, CIA, ONI, we're all in the same alphabet soup.
Really? Well, you can stick this in your alphabet soup. I had nothing to do with that United Nations killing.
Oh, we know that.
You know it? Then why did you let the police chase me all over the map?
We never interfere with the police unless absolutely necessary. It's become necessary.
Oh, I take it I'm going to be clear.
I do wish you'd walk faster, Mr. Thorny. We'll miss the plane.
Where are we going? New York or Washington?
Rapid City, South Dakota.
Rapid City? What for?
Near Mount Rushmore.
Well, thank you. I've seen Mount Rushmore.
So is your friend, Mr. Van Damme.
Van Damme?
A rather formidable kind of gentleman, eh?
Yeah. What about that treacherous little tramp with him?
Miss Kendall?
Yeah.
His mistress. We know all about her.
Tell me, what's Van Damme up to?
Oh, you could say he's a sort of importer-exporter.
Of what?
Oh, government secrets, perhaps.
Well, why don't you grab him?
Still too much we don't know about his organization.
Oh, I see. What's all this got to do with Mount Rushmore?
Well, Van Damme has a place near there. We think it's his jumping-off point to leave the country tomorrow night.
You going to stop him?
No.
Well, then what are we going there for?
Set his mind at ease about George Kaplan.
Oh, you, huh? Hmm? Well, you're George Kaplan, aren't you?
Oh, no, Mr. Thornhill. There is no such person as George Kaplan.
What do you mean there's no such person? I've been in his hotel room. I've tried on his clothes. He's got short sleeves and dandruff.
Believe me, Mr. Thornhill, he doesn't exist. Which is why I'm going to have to ask you to go on being him for the next 24 hours. Hmm. Come on, we'll discuss it on the plane.
The men continue to talk as they walk along the dark runway. Roger glances away for a moment, spotting the four whirling propellers of a silvery wide-body aeroplane. The professor clasps the brim of his brown fedora as the men continue their discussion.
Hello. You started this decoy business without me. You finish it without me.
Well, we might have if you hadn't stumbled into it.
I think you ought to give me a medal and a very long vacation instead of asking me to go on being a target just so that your special agent or whatever you call him doesn't get shot at.
Oh, not shot at, Mr. Thornhill. Found out. Once found out, they're as good as dead. Thanks to you, clouds of suspicion are already forming.
Thanks to me?
If you'll get on the plane...
Now, wait a minute. You listen to me. I'm an advertising man, not a red herring. I've got a job, a secretary, a mother, two ex-wives, and several bartenders dependent upon me. And I don't intend to disappoint them all by getting myself slightly killed. The answer is no.
Is that final?
Yes.
Well, goodbye, then.
Goodbye.
I thought there was any chance of changing your mind. I'd talk about Miss Kendall,
of whom you so obviously disapprove.
Yes. You're using sex like some people use a fly swatter.
Well, I don't suppose it would matter to you that she was probably forced to do whatever she did in order to protect herself?
To protect herself from what?
Exposure and assassination. You see, Mr. Thornhill, she's one of our agents.
Oh, no.
I know you didn't mean it, but I'm afraid you have put her in an extremely dangerous situation. And much more than her life is at stake.
Roger's face tightens into a determined stare. Daytime. Mount Rushmore's gigantic sculptured faces jut from its bare granite peak. Standing on an observation deck below the monument, Roger gazes through coin-operated binoculars.
Suppose they don't come.
They'll come.
I don't like the way Teddy Roosevelt is looking at me.
Perhaps he's trying to give you one last word of caution, Mr. Kaplan. Speak soft and carry a big stick.
I think he's trying to tell me not to go through with this harebrained scheme.
Perhaps he doesn't know to what extent you are the cause of our present trouble.
Oh, I don't know I care to accept that charge, Professor.
Dear fellow, if you hadn't made yourself so damnably attractive to Miss Kendall that she fell for you...
And vice versa.
Our friend Van Damme wouldn't be losing faith in her loyalty now. It was quite obvious to him last night that she'd become emotionally involved. Worst of all, with a man he thinks is a government agent.
Are you trying to tell me that I'm irresistible?
I'm trying to remind you that it's your responsibility to help us restore her to Van Damme's good graces...
Right up to the point he leaves the country tonight.
All right.
After tonight.
My blessings on you both.
The professor gazes studiously at a newspaper as Roger walks across the observation deck past a few mingling tourists. Roger spots two men and a woman approaching from a convertible in the parking lot.
Here they are.
The professor stands, strides briskly to the back of the observation deck and into a large glass and stone building. Roger hesitates, then hurries to another door. He enters a spacious cafeteria where 20-foot-high windows provide a view of Mount Rushmore's presidential sculptures. Roger winds his way around couples and families filling the cafeteria's tables. Stepping to the front of a service counter, he buys coffee from a waitress in a light brown uniform and hat. Carrying his cup and saucer, Roger finds an empty table facing the entrance. Eve, Van Damme, and Leonard walk through the door and head toward him. Gripping Eve's elbow with one hand, Van Damme removes his hat.
Afternoon, Mr. Captain.
Not her.
Van Damme gestures Eve away. She walks past the reptilian-eyed Leonard, who sits nearby. He watches Roger and Van Damme at their table.
Did I misunderstand you about bringing her here?
We'll get to that later. I suppose you were surprised to get my call.
Not at all. I knew the police would release you, Mr. Kaplan. By the way, I want to compliment you on your colorful exit from the auction gallery.
Thank you.
And now, what little drama are we here for today? I really don't for a moment believe that you've invited me to these gay surroundings to come to a business arrangement.
Suppose I tell you, I not only know the exact time you're leaving the country tonight, but the latitude and longitude of your rendezvous and your ultimate destination.
You wouldn't care to carry my bags for me, would you?
Perhaps you'd be interested in the price just the same.
The price?
For doing nothing to stop you.
How much did you have in mind?
I want the girl.
Van Damme's suave smile fades.
I want the girl to get what's coming to her. You turn her over to me and I'll see there's enough pinned on her to keep her uncomfortable for the rest of her life. You do that and I'll look the other way tonight.
She really did get under your skin, didn't she?
We're not talking about my skin, we're talking about yours. I'm offering you a chance to save it.
To exchange it?
Put it any way you like.
I'm curious, Mr. Kaplan. What made you arrive at the deduction that my feelings for Miss Kendall might have deteriorated to the point where I would trade her in for a little peace of mind?
I don't deduce. I observe.
He sips his coffee. Eve steps over.
Philip, if you don't mind, I'm going back to the house now.
Van Damme follows her, and Leonard joins them. Standing at the table, Roger scans the crowded room. As the trio heads for the door, Roger scurries after them and brusquely grabs Eve's arm.
Just a second, you.
Stay away from me. Let go.
Roger pulls her away, and Leonard stops Van Damme.
Leave, let go. Let go of me.
I saved the phony tears.
You just came back.
She draws the pistol from her purse.
Are you little fool?
Stay away from me.
Roger jerks forward, and a second shot knocks him down. Eve bolts.
No good, sir. Can't get involved in this.
Leonard holds back Van Damme. Eve flees outside.
Don't touch anything.
Stand back.
The professor kneels beside Roger's limp body. In the parking lot, Eve pulls away in the convertible, leaving several pursuers behind. Inside, Leonard peers through a tight circle of tourists as the professor reaches underneath Roger's body, wipes his hand clean, and gravely shakes his head. Later, Roger lies on a stretcher under a dark wool blanket as uniformed park rangers slide him into the back of a dark green station wagon. Surrounded by a mob of gathering tourists, the professor gets into the wagon. A ranger sits behind the wheel and they drive off. Later, the station wagon rolls to a stop in a sunny grove of tall, slender pine trees. The professor gets out and opens the tailgate.
Mr. Thornton?
Roger sits up and throws off the blanket. Unscathed, he crawls out of the vehicle, then turns his head and stiffens.
Don't be long.
Nearby, Eve stands next to the convertible.
Hello.
Hello.
Are you all right?
Yes, I think so.
I asked the professor if I could see you again.
Oh.
There's not much time.
Isn't there?
I wanted to tell you. I mean, apologize.
Oh, no need. I understand. All in the line of duty.
They stand face to face.
I did treat you miserably.
I hated you for it.
I didn't want you to go on thinking that I...
Well, I used some pretty harsh words. I'm sorry.
They hurt deeply.
And naturally, if I'd known...
I couldn't tell you.
Of course not.
Could I?
No, I guess not.
You didn't get hurt. I'm so relieved.
Of course I was hurt. How would you have felt?
I mean, in the cafeteria, when you fell, when I shot you with the blanks.
Oh, that? No.
You did it rather well, I thought.
Yes, I thought I was quite graceful.
Considering it's not really your kind of work.
Well, I got into it by accident. What's your excuse?
I met Philip Van Damme at a party one night and saw only his charm.
Oh.
I guess I had nothing to do that weekend, so I decided to fall in love.
Oh, that's nice.
Eventually, the professor and his Washington colleagues approached me with a few sort of details about Philip. And they told me that my relationship with him made me uniquely valuable to them.
Mm-hmm. So you became a Girl Scout, huh?
Maybe it was the first time anyone ever asked me to do anything worthwhile.
Has life been like that?
Mm-hmm.
How come?
Men like you.
What's wrong with men like me?
They don't believe in marriage.
I've been married twice.
See what I mean?
I may go back to hating you. It was more fun.
Eve desperately kisses him.
Goodbye, darling.
Wait a minute, not so soon.
I've got to get back to the house and convince them that I took the long way around so nobody followed me.
Roger pulls her close.
Couldn't we stand like this for just a few hours?
Just as time, you're supposed to be critically wounded.
I never felt more alive.
Well, whose side are you on?
Yours always, darling.
Please don't undermine my resolve just when I need it most.
The professor watches beside the ranger's car. Roger wraps his arm around Eve.
Oh, well, I guess it's off to hospital for me and back to danger for you. I don't like it a bit.
It's much safer now, thanks to you, my darling decoy.
Well, don't thank me. I couldn't stand it.
All right.
After your malevolent friend Van Damme takes off tonight, you and I are going to get together and do a lot of apologizing to each other in private.
You know that can't be.
Of course it can be.
Eve fires a spiteful glance at the professor.
Well, he has told you, hasn't he?
Told me what?
Miss Kendall, you've got to get moving.
Wait a minute. What didn't you tell me?
Why didn't you?
She's going off with Van Damme tonight on the plane.
She's going off with Van Damme.
Well, that's why we went to such lengths, to make her a fugitive from justice. So that Van Damme couldn't very well decline to take her along.
But you said...
I needn't tell you how valuable she can be to us over there.
You lied to me. You said that after tonight...
I needed your help.
Well, you got it all right.
Don't be angry.
Do you think I'm going to let you go through with this dirty business?
Well, she has to.
Nobody has to do anything. I don't like the games you play, Professor.
War is hell, Mr. Thornhill. Even when it's a cold one.
If you fellas can't lick the Van Dams of this world without asking girls like her to bed down with them and fly away with them and probably never come back, perhaps you ought to start learning how to lose a few cold wars.
I'm afraid we're already doing that.
Eve dashes to her car and gets in. The professor waves to the ranger as Roger chases after Eve.
I'm not
going to
let you
The ranger belts Roger in the face. He crumples as Eve's car peels away.
And shoot Mr. Kaplan twice in full view of scores of horrified men, women, and children.
Now, in a sparse hospital room, Roger paces bare-chested, wrapped in a white towel. He tries the doorknob. It's locked.
An attractive blonde in her late 20s. Kaplan, who was removed to the Rapid City Hospital in critical condition, has been tentatively identified as an employee of the federal government.
He moves to a window, slides it open, then closes it.
Chris Swenson, a busboy in the Mount Rushmore cafeteria, stated that he heard voices raised in...
He hops onto the bed as the door opens. The professor enters holding a garment box and a shoe box.
Here we are.
Hello.
Slacks, a shirt, and these.
Thanks.
They'll do for you around here for the next couple of days.
Yes. For the next couple of days.
Roger's side is bruised.
Hey.
What?
What's this?
Well, that's where I hit the chair during that phony fall in the cafeteria. You and your dopey schemes, shootings.
Otherwise, feeling all right?
Oh, yeah, fine. Considering your driver has a sledgehammer for a hand.
Huh. Yeah, I'm sorry about that.
Well, that's all right. I guess I deserved it. I guess I deserve that locked door, too.
Well, if you were seen wandering about in good health, it could have proved fatal to Miss Kendall.
I've begun to forget her already.
Good. Better that way.
Yeah, much.
Inside of an hour, she'll be gone.
Oh. Well, how's everything out in Rapid City?
Oh, everything's fine. Mr. Kaplan's untimely shooting has now acquired the authority of the printed word. Everyone's been cooperating beautifully.
Well... Now, you can include me. I'm a cooperator.
I'm most grateful.
Would you care to do me a favor in return?
Anything.
I'd like a drink. Could you give me a... Give me some bourbon? A pint will do.
Can I join you?
Well, if you're going to join me, you better make it a quart.
See you in a few minutes.
Yeah.
The professor shuts the door as he leaves. Now, fully dressed, Roger quickly unwraps the new shoes and slips them on. He puts one of his handkerchiefs and other small items into his pockets and heads for the door. Pressing his ear to it, Roger smiles and wraps his hand around the knob. It doesn't turn. He scowls, then checks his watch and hurries across the room to the window. Peering down at the city lights below, he slides the window open, steps on a chair, and crawls out onto a narrow stone ledge. Balancing on the foot-wide space, Roger hugs the building and clings to its brick exterior with his fingertips. Slowly, he shuffles along and reaches another window. He leaps inside a dark room, startling a sleeping young woman.
Stop!
Oh, excuse me.
She smiles.
Stop.
Later that evening, a taxi speeds up a curving wooden road. Mount Rushmore's massive stone faces loom overhead in the twilight. Amid a forest of pine trees, the taxi pulls to a stop in front of a 10-foot-high stone wall. Roger steps out and pays the driver.
Sure you don't want me to take you up there?
No, thanks. Never mind. This is fine.
Oh, thanks.
Roger stands in the open gate of a 10-foot-tall stone wall. He looks up a dirt driveway at a modern prairie-style house built on a hill. Under an indigo sky, he trots up the inclined driveway, glancing warily around the shadows. His crisp white shirt glows in the bright moonlight. With his shoulders alertly hunched, he sneaks closer to the house and takes cover behind a craggy boulder. He studies the forward wing of the house, which juts out over the steep hillside as though floating in space. Projecting eaves overhang a glass-sided room. Roger watches someone inside draw a curtain closed, then climbs up the boulder and creeps closer. Ducking a giant diagonal beam, he enters the dark cavity below the elevated wing. Awestruck, he stops to study the other beam, a slanting L-shaped cantilever which supports the wing 30 feet off the sloping ground. In the blue moonlight, Roger stoops under the giant steel beam. Looking down a dirt road, he spots two rows of runway lights flashing in a nearby clearing. Over his left shoulder, a sheer wall of the house rises imposingly, made of flat layered stones. Below a glowing window, Roger scrambles up a rocky slope to peek over a stone wall which borders the driveway. He watches a black sedan pull up and park. The slick-haired henchman hops out, carrying a newspaper. The stout, poker-faced housekeeper lets him in a side door. With narrowed eyes, Roger turns toward a large window and peers into a living room where the austere, gentlemanly Van Damme talks with Eve. The slick-haired henchman enters and gives Van Damme the newspaper. Roger creeps back down the rugged slope to the cantilever's fulcrum. His eyes follow the beam's daunting upward slope. High above him, the steel cantilever sharply intersects the projecting wing. With his jaw boldly clenched, Roger climbs onto the beam, grabs a girder over his head, and carefully steps up the sleek incline. Near the top, he climbs onto a ledge, peeks his eyes over the edge of a terrace, and spies on Van Damme and Eve in the living room.
Nothing to worry about.
I just lost my head.
I'm not just saying this to make you feel better. I mean it.
I just didn't know what I was doing.
He wanted to destroy you. You had to protect yourself.
But not endanger you.
Rubbish. Soon we'll be off together and I shall dedicate myself to your happiness. What's the situation, Leonard?
About the plane, you mean?
Of course. What was the last report?
Over Whitestone on the hour, 6,000 descending.
About 10 minutes, huh?
At the most. And now, I wonder if I might have a few words at parting with you, sir.
Certainly.
In private?
I'll go up and get my things.
Well, Leonard, I just want to say goodbye to one's right arm.
With a preoccupied stare, Leonard watches Eve close her bedroom door, then turns to his boss.
In your case, sir, I'm afraid you're going to wish you had cut it off sooner.
Hmm?
I know how terribly fond you are of Miss Kent. I don't find this a terribly attractive...
Outside, a light shines on Roger. It's the light from Eve's second-floor bedroom. Watching her pack a suitcase, Roger takes a coin from his pocket and throws it at the window. Eve looks up, then goes back to packing. Cautiously, Roger glances into the living room, then aims again. This time, Eve steps out onto a terrace, but doesn't see Roger hiding below her and to the right. Roger opens his mouth to call out, but spots Leonard heading for the living room terrace. The lanky henchman stands at the open door, scans the dark grounds, then turns back to Van Damme.
It couldn't have been anything.
Hiding a pistol behind his back, he sits beside the African statuette.
You must have had some doubts about it yourself. And still do.
Rubbish.
Why else would you have decided not to tell her that our little treasure here has a belly full of microfilm?
You seem to be trying to fill mine with rotten apples.
Sometimes the truth does taste like a mouthful of worms.
Truth? I've heard nothing but innuendo.
Call it my woman's intuition, if you will. But I've never trusted neatness. Neatness is always a result of deliberate planning.
She shot him in a moment of fear and anger. You were there yourself, you saw it.
Yes.
He stands, gripping the pistol behind him.
And thereby wrapped everything up into one very neat and tidy bundle. Hey, she removed any doubts you may have had about her, what did you call it, her devotion? And B, she gave herself a new and urgent reason to be taken over to the other side with you, just in case you decided to change your mind.
You know what I think? I think you're jealous. No, I mean it. I'm very touched. Very.
Leonard aims point blank at Van Damme.
Leonard?
Van Damme flinches as smoke blasts from the pistol. Unharmed, he gapes disbelievingly.
The gun she shot Kaplan with. I found it in her luggage. It's an old Gestapo trick. Shoot one of your own people to show that you're not one of them. They've just freshened it up a bit with blank cartridges.
Van Damme winds up and slugs Leonard in the jaw. Leonard falls back into an easy chair as Van Damme rubs his knuckles. Above them, Eve comes to the railing of an interior balcony overlooking the living room.
What was that noise?
The men look up nonchalantly.
Yes, we wondered what it was, too, didn't we, Leonard? Hurry on down, darling. It's almost time to leave.
In a moment.
With a moist, disheartened gaze, Van Damme watches her return to the bedroom. Leonard springs hastily from the chair.
You're not taking her on that plane with you.
Of course I am. Like our friends, I too believe in neatness, Leonard. This matter is best disposed of from a great height over water.
Outside, Roger's eyes flit back and forth as he listens. Then he drops to his hands and knees. He crawls along the ledge to a wall of flat layered stones. Above him, Eve continues to pack in her bedroom. Gripping the coarse surface, he begins to scale the wall, slowly climbing up to Eve's window. Roger steps deftly from the wall to the ledge around Eve's terrace just as she picks up her suitcase, switches off the light, and leaves the room. Stepping carefully, Roger clears the terrace railing and enters the dark bedroom. He tiptoes swiftly across the floor, opens the door, and cautiously gazes down to the living room.
How about a little champagne before we go?
I'd love it.
Over
the rocks will be all right.
Sure.
Stepping back into the bedroom, Roger looks at his hand. The palm is stained with blood. Taking a handkerchief from his pocket, he presses it against the abrasion, then notices his monogram, R-O-T. Reaching back into his pockets, Roger discovers one of his monogrammed matchbooks and a pencil. He opens the matchbook and scribbles a note on the inside of the cover. He writes, "They're on to you. I'm in your room." Roger's handsome features sharpen, and his eyes dart back and forth as he scans the hallway. Hidden in shadows, he slides out of the room and creeps down a few steps to the overlooking balcony. He presses against a wall of layered stones and peers down into the living room. Downstairs, Van Damme strolls from a wet bar to a sofa where Eve sits beside her purse and gloves. He sets down a bottle of champagne and offers Eve a glass.
Thank you.
To you, my dear, and all the lovely moments we've had together.
Thank you.
There he is.
Leonard gazes out a window to the landing strip. Upstairs, Roger tosses the matchbook to the floor beside Eve.
Jump in, Leonard. The champagne's fine. There isn't time. You always were a spoiled sport, weren't you? One of my most valuable attributes, as it now turns out.
Leonard approaches Eve.
It would please me if you would think of me as being along on this journey. If only in spirit.
I shall, Leonard.
Roger winces as Leonard notices the matchbook. Leonard picks it up, calmly drops it on a coffee table, and turns away.
He's heading pretty far out on the north leg and awfully high.
Eve spots the matches.
I guess he's going to play it safe with a long, slow descent. Couldn't ask for a better night than this. Ceiling and possibilities unlimited. Ah, there he goes, starting his turn. Well, we better get moving.
Eve reads the note and shudders.
He should have his wheels on the ground inside of 3 minutes.
Roger dashes into the bedroom as the men turn away from the window.
Along, Eve.
All right.
She touches her ear.
Oh, I think I left my earrings upstairs. I'll be right down.
The men trade an apprehensive look. With quick, deliberate steps, Eve reaches the bedroom and turns on the light. Roger steps forward and shuts the door.
Darling, we can get out through the window. There's a car downstairs.
What are you doing here, Roger? You ruined everything.
Now listen to me. They know all about the fake shooting. They're going to do away with you.
What are you talking about?
Leonard found the gun with the blanks in it in your luggage. And the figure that they got at the auction sale last night is filled with microfilm.
That's how he's been getting it.
Don't get on that plane.
Eve hurries out of the room and joins Leonard, who stands waiting for her. Downstairs, Van Damme talks with the housekeeper.
Don't worry, Anna. Arrangements have been made. You and your husband will be over the Canadian border by tomorrow morning.
Thank you very much, sir. Here. We will, sir, and God bless you.
Van Damme waves to the stout, dour-faced Anna. Holding the statue, he joins Eve, who wraps a wide orange shawl around her shoulders. From the balcony, Roger watches them leave.
I'll wait, sir.
Unable to see them from his hiding place, Roger cranes his neck and listens attentively. He slips away from the wall. Downstairs, Anna walks back into the living room and collects the two empty champagne glasses. As she walks across the room, she notices Roger's reflection in a television screen. Keeping her back to him, she sets the glasses on top of the set and disappears into another room. From the balcony, Roger watches her leave and creeps down the stairs. Nearing the bottom, he looks up and freezes.
Stay where you are.
Standing in a shadowy hallway, Anna aims a small pistol at him. Keeping the gun trained on Roger, the maid walks forward and sits in a chair a few feet away.
Sit down.
Roger slowly crouches down on a stair, keeping his eyes fixed on the weapon.
As soon as the plane leaves, my husband and Mr. Leonard will be back.
Outside, carrying the statue, Van Damme holds Eve close to his side. Leonard walks closely behind the couple as they head down a long dirt path toward the landing strip. The plane touches down, and Eve anxiously looks back to the house. Van Damme eyes her suspiciously, and they continue down the path. Eve's jaw clenches as she takes another desperate look back up the hill.
What is this?
I was wondering about my earrings.
Well, they'll turn up.
They arrive at the open door of the passenger plane.
When you return to New York, say goodbye to my sister for me. And thank her for her superb performance, Mr. Townsend.
Calderon.
And tell your knife-throwing chum that I've reassured his wife.
Right.
That's about all, isn't it?
As the slick-haired henchmen load their bags, Van Damme pushes Eve toward the plane, suddenly from the house. Roger dashes out the door to the car parked nearby. Eve snatches the statue and runs back up the hill.
Get that figure back from her.
The henchmen race after Eve as the car barrels toward them. She jumps in and Roger speeds away.
The housekeeper had me pinned down for 5 minutes before I realized it was that same silly gun of yours.
I see you've got the pumpkin.
Yes.
Roger stops in front of the wooden gate, hops out, and yanks on the chain lock. 100 yards behind him, Leonard and the slick-haired henchmen race down the driveway with flashlights. Grabbing the statuette, Eve rushes to warn Roger. He grabs her hand, and they run into the pine woods. As they quickly weave through the leafy brush, Eve's shawl catches on a branch. Roger slips it off her shoulders. 50 yards back, Leonard and the henchmen split up. At the far edge of the forest, Roger and Eve stop abruptly. The smooth stone tops of four massive heads rise before their dazed eyes.
This is no good. We're on top of the monument.
They spot shining flashlights to their right and left. Roger's face twists in an anxious frown. They dash toward the monument. The stony eyes of Washington, Jefferson, Roosevelt, and Lincoln stare into the dusky night. Roger and Eve flee onto the crown of Jefferson's head and peer down the precipice.
What do we do?
Climb down.
We can't.
Here they come. We have no choice.
They clamber down the gap between Washington's and Jefferson's colossal busts. With their fingertips curled over a narrow lip, they grip the ridged granite that forms the soft waves of Jefferson's sculpted hair. Their dizzying view down plunges endlessly into a rocky abyss. Looming over their shoulders, Jefferson's 3-foot-tall, stone-cut eye looks out from below a heavy brow. Roger and Eve inch their way down the grooved rock. On the far side of Washington's stoic profile, the slick-haired henchman climbs down the sculpture's rippled rock curls. Meanwhile, Leonard claws his way down Lincoln's head. Clinging to Jefferson's wavy locks, Roger and Eve catch their breath.
Well, if we ever get out of this alive, let's go back to New York on the train together. All right?
Is that a proposition?
It's a proposal, sweetie.
What happened to the first two marriages?
My wife's divorced me.
Why?
Oh, I think they said I led too dull a life. Come on.
Her heel snaps. She slips down the sheer face and lands on a thin shelf. Roger descends Jefferson's stepped waves to kneel beside her.
You all right?
Roger helps her off with her jacket. Wincing in pain, she cradles her elbow and collapses into Roger's arms. He comfortingly strokes her hair.
Okay, come on. Come on, yeah.
Her face twists in agony as Roger helps her down the steep rock.
Come on.
Meanwhile, the slick-haired henchman scrambles down the other side of Washington's profile, stepping carefully in his leather loafers. Across the monument on Lincoln's head, Leonard clings desperately to a sheer wall of combed granite. His flashlight slips out of his pocket. He loses his footing, dangles momentarily from his fingertips, then tumbles sideways onto a thin ledge. Slowly, he pulls himself to his feet. Level with Jefferson's chin, Roger and Eve catch their breath and scan the cliffs. To the right, TR's spectacled profile and Lincoln's gentle face tower imposingly. Washington's statuesque bust looms to the left. Below them, the forbidding cliff drops suddenly down to a pine-studded valley. They head right, passing below Jefferson's square jaw. Suddenly, they stop. Roger points the microfilm statuette toward Leonard on the far side of Lincoln's beard, then leads Eve the other way. Hand in hand, they scramble up Washington's smooth, rounded shoulder. The night wind brushes Eve's blonde hair over her face. Behind them, Leonard climbs up to Jefferson's profile. Roger slides down Washington's sloping chest, then turns to help Eve as she inches down barefoot. As they cautiously traverse the broad bust, Leonard slides down the shoulder. Pressed against a ridged wall, Roger and Eve sidestep along a narrow ledge. Just over Roger's shoulder, Eve glimpses the slick-haired henchman. The henchman tackles Roger, and they tumble down the rugged slope. Gaping in horror, Eve bites her knuckles. The henchman pins Roger down and aims a knife at his throat. Roger grips the assassin's wrist and heaves him off the cliff. The henchman plummets.
Ah!
Roger looks up as Leonard wrestles the statuette away from Eve, then pushes her off the ledge. Eve clings to the sheer rock by her fingertips. Below her, the cliff plunges hundreds of feet into the valley. Roger hurries over and reaches down. His outstretched fingers fall inches short of hers. Her meager foothold breaks off. Roger catches Eve's wrist as she falls. Under the strain, his single handhold on the rock starts to slip. He pleadingly looks up at Leonard.
Help! Help me!
Holding the statuette, Leonard hesitates, then climbs down. He steps on Roger's clinging fingertips and grinds them under the sole of his shoe. Roger winces. Leonard coldly watches Eve struggle to hang on. Leonard drops the statuette and topples off the cliff. On top of a nearby bluff, the professor lowers his binoculars as a policeman holsters his pistol.
Thank you, Sergeant.
That wasn't very sporting, using real bullets.
Eve dangles from Roger's grip.
Come on, I've got you. Up.
I can't make it.
Yes, you can. Come on.
Roger!
Come along, Mrs. Thornhill.
Roger pulls Eve onto a train bunk.
Oh, Roger, this is silly.
I know, but I'm sentimental.
They melt into a breathless kiss as the train thunders into a tunnel. Titles appear. The End. North by Northwest. Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer.